In the preceding lecture, I endeavored to give you a general view of the nature of theology and pointed out its superiority to every other subject of study. As it treats of God and divine things, of our duty and our hopes, it is equally interesting to the learned and the unlearned. I showed you that it is distinguished into natural and supernatural or revealed theology, and that of the latter there are three divisions, didactic, polemic, and practical theology. Didactic theology explains the doctrines of religion and states the proofs or the arguments by which their truth is evinced. Polemic theology considers the controversies respecting those doctrines and replies to the objections of adversaries. It is the business of practical theology to point out the improvement which should be made of the doctrines by detailing the duties incumbent upon those who profess to receive them as true and the motives which they supply to the faithful performance of these duties. I concluded by laying before you some of the qualifications for the study of theology, and I mentioned piety, without which the study, if not unsuccessful, will certainly be unprofitable, a competent share of human learning, which is indispensably necessary to eminence in your profession, and the love of truth, or a sincere desire to know the will of God, leading to candor, diligence in your inquiries. Let us now proceed to inquire what are the sources of theology, or, in other words, what are the sources from which our knowledge of it is derived. These are reason and revelation. Here, our attention is demanded to such questions as these, whether reason and revelation are both necessary. If only one, whether is it reason or revelation? And lastly, if reason alone is insufficient, how far its discoveries extend, and what are its defects which are supplied by revelation? Reason signifies in this place the intellectual and moral faculties of man exercised without any supernatural assistance in the investigation of religion. Whether under its guidance he can attain all the knowledge which is necessary to conduct him to virtue and happiness is the great subject of controversy between infidels and Christians. There is another dispute among Christians themselves with respect to the degree of its ability. While some maintain that it can discover the doctrines of what is called natural religion, others affirm that these could not be known without the aid of revelation. Nothing is more unphilosophical and a more certain source of error than to indulge in vague speculations and barren generalities upon any subject, when it is in our power to enter into a close investigation of it, and to bring it to the test of experience. It is easy to present to us a system of religion containing a variety of articles supported by a train of arguments which seem to amount to demonstration, and to tell us that reason, being the gift of God, must be perfectly sufficient to direct men in all the parts of their duty, that religion being a general concern, they would not be responsible unless they were all furnished with the means of acquiring the knowledge of it, that the supposition of supplementary means is a reflection upon the wisdom of God, as if he had not originally adapted man to his situation, and was hence compelled to devise a new expedient for correcting the error. Without examining these assertions one by one, and showing, which we might do, that they are mere gratuitous assumptions, it may suffice to observe that not a single fact in the history of mankind can be adduced in confirmation of them. They are an utopian description of an imaginary state, not a sober relation of things which really exist. They are a priori arguments, or arguments deduced from our own previous conceptions, not arguments a posteriori, or founded on observation and experience. The question is not what should be according to our ideas of justice and fitness, but what actually is, not what purposes reason abstractly considered may be presumed to accomplish, but what purposes reason as existing in men is found to have actually accomplished. It is preposterous, first, to give an arbitrary definition of reason, and then to conclude that it is capable of exerting all the power which we have been pleased to ascribe to it. It is more consonant to sound philosophy to judge of the power of reason by its effects. In a word, we must not waste our time and impose upon ourselves by endeavoring to show beforehand what reason can do. We ought to proceed according to a different and a safer plan, and inquire what it has actually done. It may be proper to remark that there are two senses in which reason may be understood, and consequently that what is true of it in one sense may not be true in another. First, reason may signify the high intellectual ability with which man was endowed at his creation, and which we may conceive to have been as sufficient to direct him in his original state as instinct is to direct the lower animals, both being perfect in their kind. I would not affirm, however, that even then, reason was his only guide, because it appears from the sacred history that he lived in familiar intercourse with his Maker, and was favored with occasional communications of his will. Secondly, reason may signify the intellectual powers of man in his present state, when he feels the effects of the fall in all his faculties, and both his mind and conscience are defiled. It is with reason in this sense alone that we have at present to do. It is no more an impeachment of the wisdom and goodness of God to affirm the incompetence of corrupt reason in matters of religion than it is to say that an eye which in consequence of disease does not see at all, or sees imperfectly, is unfit for the purpose which it was originally intended to serve. From the preceding observations, we perceive that it is not from theory, but from experiment, not from conjecture, but from fact, that we can ascertain what assistance may be expected from reason in the study of theology. Let us then review some of the doctrines of what is called natural religion, and is supposed properly to lie within the province of reason, that we may see what has been the result of its researches. The first principle of religion is the existence of God, who made us, and to whom we owe homage and obedience. No doubt seems to be entertained that this fundamental truth is demonstrable by reason, and accordingly there are many books in which it is evinced by arguments so strong and conclusive that it is not easy to conceive how any man who has attended to them can continue an atheist. The metaphysician, we should think, would be overpowered by the profound reasonings of Clark, and the man of a plainer understanding by the more obvious proofs collected in the writings of Ray and Durham and Paley. There is one thing which ought not to be overlooked, that this triumphant demonstration, as it may be justly called, is found only in the writings of Christians. For although a similar train was pursued by some of the heathen philosophers, as Cicero in his work concerning the nature of the gods and Socrates in the dialogues of Xenophon, the illustration was not so ample as it is now made by the discoveries of modern philosophy, nor was the conclusion to which it naturally led drawn with equal clearness and confidence. The cause of this difference we are at no loss to divine. To the Gentiles, the existence of God was a point involved in doubt, an inference to be deduced from premises, and they who saw some steps of the process were not always able to see with equal distinctness the result. When Christians sit down to discuss the subject, they are fully convinced of the fact, and how different it is to discover an unknown truth by a slow induction of particulars, and to find out proofs of a truth already admitted. How much easier the one process is than the other, you will perceive upon the slightest reflection. The former is like the voyage of Columbus, who did not know whether there was a country as America, and had nothing but probability to support him amidst the difficulties and perils of the enterprise. The latter is like the same voyage now, when the place being known, the sailor can shape his course to it by his chart and compass. Nature, it is acknowledged, cries aloud in all her works that there is a God. But she spoke in vain, as a late writer observes, to the sages of antiquity, who either altogether failed to interpret her language, or suffered the still whisper of divine philosophy to be lost amidst the various bustle of the world. The ancients, imperfect as their sciences were, knew more than enough of the harmony and design of the universe to draw out an unanswerable argument from final causes, and in point of fact they did draw out both that and other arguments, so far as to leave us an indisputable proof that the God of natural theology will never be anything more than the dumb idol of philosophy, neglected by the philosopher himself, and unknown to the multitude, acknowledged in the closet and forgotten in the world. This truth made no impression upon their minds, and it is not surprising that it did not, as their notions of it were exceedingly imperfect and erroneous. The idea of what has been called the personality of the deity, or his distinct subsistence, was in a great measure unknown to them. The deity was considered not so much an intelligent being as an animating power diffused throughout the world, and was introduced into their speculative system to account for the motion of that passive mass of matter which was supposed coeval and coexisting with himself. In practice, they adopted the polytheism of their country, and paid religious honors to the endless train of gods and goddesses who were acknowledged by the vulgar. There was not a nation upon earth but the Jews, in which the living and true God was adored. Every object was mistaken for him. Every part of the universe was deified, and fancy exerted its creative power in superadding a multitude of imaginary beings, insomuch that the gods of Greece, that seat of refinement and philosophy, amounted to 30,000. In modern India, where science has long been cultivated, the number is still greater, and we are astonished at the information that its gods are estimated by millions. Such are the achievements of reason with respect to the first principle of religion. In the second place, it is the office of religion to inform us of our relation to God, because this is the foundation of our duty to Him. Although we should conceive the existence of an all-perfect being, if there subsisted no connection between Him and us, how much soever His excellencies might excite our admiration, He would have no claim to our homage and obedience. By us, God is regarded in the characters of our Creator and Governor. And these ideas are so familiar to our minds, and so interwoven with our sentiments and feelings from our infancy, that they appear to us almost self-evident, and we can scarcely think it possible that they should not occur to every person of reflection. We believe that all things were created by the almighty power of God, and although the production of the universe out of nothing is an event of which we can form no conception, because experience has not made us acquainted with anything similar, yet we consider the cause as adequate, omnipotence being able to do everything which does not imply a contradiction. But men, having the light of nature alone as their guide, entertained different sentiments. Unassisted reason never arrived at this conclusion, that the universe had a beginning, nor when it was suggested did it obtain its assent. Ex nihilo nihil fit, nothing is made out of nothing, was a maxim received without dispute by all the sages of antiquity. In the detail of their systems they differed from each other, but they all concurred in rejecting as absurd the idea of a proper creation. Some of them believed that the universe was eternal both in matter and form, that the sun, moon, and stars in the heavens, plants, animals, and minerals on the earth had always been, and that the human race had no beginning and would have no end. Others maintained that the present order of things had a beginning, but they attributed it to accident, to the fortuitous concourse of atoms, which, dancing up and down in infinite space, united themselves at last in the present regular system. Of those who acknowledged a deity, some, instead of considering him as the creator, confounded him with his works, and imagined him to be a soul or vital principle diffused throughout the universe, and giving life and motion to its various parts, as the soul of man animates his body, while others, although they distinguished him from the universe, did not believe that he made it, but only that he reduced the wild, chaotic mass into order. According to all of them, matter was co-eternal with the deity, and only thus far dependent upon him that his power was exerted in moving and arranging it. Their notion, therefore, of the relation of man to God must have been very different from ours, who believe that he made us and the earth on which we dwell, and the heavens which shed their influences upon us, and that in him we live and move and have our being. We could not expect those who were so much mistaken or so imperfectly informed with respect to the character of God as the creator of the world to entertain just ideas of his government of it. It was natural for such philosophers as attributed the present system to chance to deny a providence, and accordingly the followers of Epicurus represented the gods as indolently reposing in their own region of undisturbed felicity, and beholding with indifference the concerns of mortals. The sentiments of some other philosophers were different, and we are delighted to hear them expressing themselves in a manner approaching in accuracy and sublimity to the discourses of those who have derived their knowledge from the high source of revelation. Of religion towards the gods, says Epictetus, this is the principal thing, to form right conceptions of them as existing, and administering all things well and justly, to obey them and acquiesce in all things that happen, and to follow willingly as being under the conduct of the most excellent mind. But the elevated language of the Stoics loses much of its value when we reflect upon their doctrine of fate, which meant some inexplicable necessity by which all things were controlled, and to which gods as well as men were compelled to yield. The world, then, was not properly governed by the gods, but they, as well as their nominal subjects, were governed by fate, and bound by the eternal and inviolable chain of causes and effects. The opinion of the vulgar was more simple. The dominion of the gods was acknowledged by their prayers and thanksgivings, and other religious services. But even in their creed, the power of the gods was circumscribed by stern, irresistible necessity, or was exercised with all the wantonness of caprice, and as they did not hesitate to say in some instances with injustice, the idea of a providence floated in the minds of the heathens, but they were not able to give it a distinct and consistent shape. All that reason could do was to point out the general truth. It failed in its attempts to illustrate it, and to erect upon this foundation the superstructure of rational piety. Let us in the next place inquire what have been the discoveries of reason in morality. Here it must be acknowledged that its success has been greater. There are admirable treatises upon morality, which were composed by heathen philosophers, and may be perused with pleasure and advantage. But he is very ignorant indeed who imagines that he shall find in them a perfect system of duty. Lactantius, indeed, has somewhere affirmed that everything delivered in the scriptures on this subject is contained in the writings of one or other of the philosophers. But Lactantius, although a fine reasoner and an elegant writer, is not entitled to much deference in questions of theology, of which he has shown himself to be an incompetent judge. What he has affirmed is not true, for in the moral systems of the philosophers some duties of great importance are omitted, and some things which they call virtues, when brought to the Christian standard, turn out to be vices. According to Cicero, virtue proposes glory as its end, and looks for no other reward. Zeno maintained that all crimes are equal, and that a person who has offended or injured us should never be forgiven. It was his opinion, as well as that of other philosophers, that the crime against nature is a matter of indifference. The Cynics held that there was nothing shameful in committing acts of lewdness in public. Aristippus affirmed that as pleasure was the summum bonum, a man might practice theft, sacrilege, or adultery as he had opportunity. Humility, which is the first of Christian virtues, was despised as an indication of a mean, dastardly spirit, and the tendency of their moral lessons was to inspire a notion of personal dignity, a feeling of self-approbation, a consciousness of worth, which of all tempers the scriptures pronounce to be the most offensive to our Maker. Besides, the morality of the heathens, imperfect as it was, wanted authority, being rather a deduction of reason than a law emanating from the author of our being, of the communications of whose will they were ignorant. It had little or no power over conscience, and the motives with which it was enforced were not of sufficient efficacy to counteract the innate propensity to evil, and to overcome the strong temptations to which men are daily exposed. Hence a general depravity of manners prevailed among the ancient Gentiles, and still prevails among modern heathens, to a degree of which, corrupt as Christian countries are, we can hardly form a conception. A depravity which extended not only to the lower and uneducated classes, but to the higher and better informed, and even to the very men who professed to be teachers of wisdom. We are apt to impose upon ourselves or to be imposed upon by others when we are thinking of the heathen philosophers. We look upon them as a set of sages who spent their days in the study and practice of virtue. But the particulars of their history which have come down to us, and the testimony of some of their own order, will correct this mistake, and show us that they were unprincipled declaimers, whose infamous conduct daily gave the lie to their eloquent harangues. Suspicion rests upon the most celebrated names, and with respect even to Socrates, the visit which he paid to an Athenian courtesan to see her beauty and to teach her more perfectly the arts of seduction, and the profane oaths with which his conversation was interlarded, with some other particulars in his history, place him at an immense distance from the lowest member of a Christian church. Were this wisest of men, according to the oracle, this pattern of every excellence according to the nonsensical panegyrics of pedants and fools, now to appear among us, no man with correct ideas of piety and morality would choose to be seen in his company. Lastly, what was the result of the inquiries of reason with respect to the immortality of the soul? A doctrine of primary importance in religion. The common people generally believed that the soul survived the death of the body, and that there was a future state of rewards and punishments, but they could assign no reason for the belief, but the authority of their ancestors and popular writers, especially the poets, the theologians of the vulgar. The doctrine had not been adopted by their ancestors in consequence of a process of reasoning, from which it was the legitimate inference, but they also had received it without examination upon the testimony of others. When thus traced back from age to age, it appears that it was a tradition, or a fragment of revelation preserved amidst the general wreck, and consequently, that it is unfair to produce this article as a proof of the sagacity of reason in the investigation of truth. The philosophers, not content with implicit faith, endeavored to prove the immortality of the soul by argument. But although they enjoyed this advantage, that the fact was known, and it was left to them only to bring evidence in support of it, they had no great cause to congratulate themselves on their success. Some of their arguments may be admitted to be good, but this praise is not due to them all. In the Phaedo of Plato, the reasoning is often exceedingly obscure, and arguments are employed so fanciful and so manifestly false that while we cannot avoid pitying those who grope their way by the dubious twilight of nature, we are not surprised that they should have produced no permanent conviction in the mind. "I know not how it happens," says Cicero, "that when I read, I assent. But when I have laid down the book, all that assent vanishes." After all the arguments which the philosophers could muster up, suspicion haunted their minds, that there was some step in the process which weakened the force of the conclusion. Socrates himself died in doubt, as we learn from the close of his apology as given by Plato. "It is time," he says to his judges, "for us to depart, that I may die and you may live. To which of us shall it be better is unknown to all but God." This uncertainty, this hesitation, we should take into the account when we light upon some passage in which the confidence of hope is expressed, and death seems to be longed for as a dismission from this vile and worthless crowd into the divine council and assembly of souls. Their thoughts were as changeable as some of our days, which are alternately darkened by clouds and rain, and cheered by gleams of sunshine. This induction of particulars will serve to prove the insufficiency of reason to acquire the knowledge of the principles of natural theology. Let no man presume to tell us that it is sufficient, till he can point out an instance in which, without any assistance, it has discovered and established by satisfactory arguments the great truths of religion. And here I may observe that, little as reason has done, we have no evidence that it could have done so much if all aid had been withheld, and it had been left to work out its discoveries alone. But its solitary strength has not been fairly tried, for man has never been without revelation, and although it was in a great measure lost among the nations of the world, yet some fragments of it remained, with which they contrived to make up their various systems of religion. From this source they derived the general idea of the existence of a God, and their notions of providence, of morality, and of a future state, and still more plainly their oracles and prophets, their sacrifices, and the opinion of the placability of the divine nature, upon which they were founded. Tradition was supplementary to reason. Its light, indeed, was faint, but still it served to show dimly some objects which the eye of reason could not have discovered amidst the surrounding darkness. "Though the ancients," says Schuckford, referring to their theories concerning the origin of things, but his observations are applicable to other parts of theology, "though the ancients have hinted many of the positions laid down by Moses, yet we do not find that they ever made use of any true and solid reasoning, or were masters of any clear and well-grounded learning, which might lead them to the knowledge of these truths. All the knowledge which the ancients had on these points lay at first in a narrow compass. They were in possession of a few truths which they had received from their forefathers. They transmitted these to their children, only telling them that such and such things were so, but not giving them reasons for, or demonstrations of, the truth of them. Philosophy was not disputative until it came into Greece. The ancient professors had no controversies about it. They received what was handed down to them, and out of the treasure of their traditions imparted to others, and the principles they went upon to teach or to learn by were not to search into the nature of things or to consider what they could find by philosophical examinations, but ask, and it shall be told you. Search the records of antiquity, and you shall find what you inquire after. These were the maxims and directions of their studies. We have now seen how defective reason is in what may be considered to be its proper province, natural theology. If we proceed to supernatural theology, we shall find that here it is altogether useless. It cannot make a single discovery. It is like the eye which is capable of perceiving objects upon earth that are not placed at too great a distance from it, but cannot discern those parts of creation which lie in the profound abysses of space, unless it be assisted by art. The line which separates natural and supernatural theology is impassable. On the one side of it there are some gleams of light, on the other there is impenetrable darkness. Supernatural theology is founded on that mysterious distinction in the divine essence which we call the Trinity, a distinction not altogether unknown to the heathen philosophers, as is evident from the writings of Plato and his followers, but which every person acknowledges they had learned from tradition. Although reason could demonstrate the existence of God and his unity, it possesses no premises from which it could infer a plurality in his nature. It is a secret which he alone could disclose. Supernatural theology is also founded on the divine counsels respecting our fallen race, of which no trace can be looked for in creation, as they relate to a state of things posterior to it, and different from the state in which mankind was originally placed. We may investigate the design of our Maker in the formation of the universe by observing the apparent tendency of his works, and say that in subordination to the display of his perfections, it is the diffusion of happiness. But how shall we ascertain, except by information from himself, what is his design with respect to his revolted subjects, if he has any other design than to punish them? Some Christians have asserted that in the works of God there is an obscure revelation of grace, and the celebrated infidel writer Lord Herbert has laid it down as one of his 5 articles of natural religion, that if men repent of their sins they will be forgiven, and this I apprehend is the meaning of the former, when they speak of a revelation of grace. But nature teaches no such thing, for first there is nothing in creation or even in the dispensations of providence, which, when fairly interpreted, indicates an intention on the part of God to pardon his disobedient creatures. And secondly, the principle assumed as the dictate of nature is false, it being the express doctrine of Scripture that God does not pardon sinners upon repentance, without an atonement, of which nature knows nothing. But it is unnecessary to waste time upon a point so plain, so that the scheme of redemption being founded on the sovereign will of God and the purpose which he formed before the foundation of the world could be known only by divine communication and by its actual execution. Whether Job speaks of it or not, the following words will admit of an easy application to it. Where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man knoweth not the price thereof, neither is it found in the land of the living. The depth saith, it is not in me, and the sea saith, it is not with me. Whence then cometh wisdom? And where is the place of understanding? Seeing it is hidden from the eyes of all living and kept close from the fowls of the air, destruction and death say we have heard the fame thereof with our ears. God understandeth the way thereof, and he knoweth the place thereof. When he made a decree for the rain, and a way for the lightning of the thunder, then did he see it, and declare it. He prepared it, yea, and searched it out. And unto men he said, Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. It is not my intention in these observations upon the insufficiency of reason to insinuate that it ought to be entirely discarded from religion. You will ask, then, what purpose does it serve? And to this question I shall endeavor to return an answer in the remaining part of this lecture. Its first office is to judge of the evidence of religion. And while thus employed, it not only collects proofs from observation and experience in favor of the doctrines of natural theology, but examines the grounds upon which any new doctrine is said to be a divine communication. As various systems of religion have claimed to proceed from this high source, it brings them to the test. There are 2 ways in which this inquiry may be conducted. We may compare the system which demands our assent with our prior conceptions of the divine character and will, in order to ascertain whether it harmonizes with them, because it is certain that sound reason and a genuine revelation cannot contradict each other. Or we may consider certain circumstances extrinsic to the revelation itself, by which its pretensions to a supernatural origin may be determined. As I have not yet spoken directly of revelation, I am rather anticipating what would have been introduced more properly afterwards, but its connection with the preceding part of the lecture is my apology for bringing it forward at present. The external circumstances to which I allude are the character of the publishers of the system, the nature of their testimony, and the works to which they appeal in attestation of their mission, of all which reason is competent to judge. The doctrines of the system may be so far beyond its range that it shall be altogether incapable of deciding upon their truth or falsehood by an abstract contemplation of them, while the marks of truth with which they are accompanied may be of easy apprehension and carry conviction to any ordinary understanding. He who is not able by his own researches to discover a truth may find no difficulty in estimating the force of the proofs by which it is supported. We do not then retract what has been formerly said concerning the weakness of reason in matters of religion, when we constitute it judge of its evidence, in which there is nothing mysterious, nothing which is not as plain to a common understanding as the subjects which the mind is called upon to consider in the common course of affairs. The second office of reason is to examine the contents of Revelation, to ascertain the sense of the words and phrases in which it is expressed, to bring to the illustration of it our previous knowledge of subjects connected with it, to trace the relation of its parts, and to draw out in regular order the system of doctrines and duties which it teaches. Our intellectual powers must be exercised with a view to obtain a distinct idea of the import of any communication which our Creator has condescended to make of His will. If we had no more understanding than the irrational animals, we should be equally incapable as they of religion. And if we did not employ our understanding in the study of it, it would be addressed to us in vain. God, having given us rational powers, requires us to exert them in the search of truth, and they are never so worthily employed as in endeavoring to acquire just notions of His character and our relation to Him, of the duty which He has enjoined upon us, and the hopes which His goodness authorizes us to entertain. You will perceive that the province which we have assigned to reason does not constitute a judge of religion. It is not the doctrines of religion which we submit to its test, but the evidence. Let it canvass the evidence and proceed to settle by the laws of criticism and common sense the genuine import of revelation. But here it should stop. Hitherto shalt thou come, and no farther. The wisdom of God must not be tried by the foolishness of men. In the former case, reason acts as a servant. In the latter, it assumes the authority of a master. Man exchanges the character of a scholar for that of a teacher, and presumes to dictate to his maker. I will not receive such doctrines, because I cannot conceive how they can be true. The ideas which they associate appear to me to be contradictory. Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Presumptuous mortal! The range of thy thoughts extends only to a small portion of the universe, and of the objects which lie within this limited space, there is not one of which thou hast a perfect comprehension, and yet thou speakest as if thy mind grasped all the possibilities. How canst thou tell what may or what may not be in the infinite essence of the Creator, or what counsels are worthy of that understanding which comprehends time and eternity by one act of intuition? Who can by searching find out God? Who can find out the Almighty unto perfection? He dwells in thick darkness, and the proper posture for thee is to fall down with humility and reverence before Him, whose judgments are unsearchable, and whose ways are past finding out.